We will talk about political gridlock and the damage it can do this hour, and wonder why compromise seems to be a dirty word in American politics these days. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Wednesday, July the 6th. Do you want to see more bipartisan cooperation from politicians in Wisconsin, in Minnesota, in Washington, D.C.? Or do you want your elected officials to stick to their guns? We will welcome your thoughts and questions for our guest who writes Duke University's Gridlock blog at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. David Schanzer is an associate professor at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy and the director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Thank you so much for being with us. Well, the subtitle of your Gridlock blog is, Can Our System Address America's Big Problems? So what's the answer to that question, given the current state of gridlock?
Well, oftentimes people use the term gridlock to refer to when you have divided government and one side can't agree with the other. But I use the term to cast a broader net and to be the shorthand for a series of dysfunctions in our political system that renders this our society, not just one part of the government or the other, almost incapable of dealing with the large-scale challenges that face us. So right now, my fear is that the answer to the subtitle in my blog is no.
Well, why is that?
Well, it's complicated, and there's a lot of aspects to it. But we have a culture of hyper-partisanship. There's an unwillingness to compromise, inability of society as a whole to agree that sacrifices are often necessary for the common good, and even a basic unwillingness of individuals and their representatives to acknowledge facts that are established in policy or in science that are inconsistent or inconvenient to their kind of preconceived notions or ideology. So it's a very deeply ingrained part of our culture, and there are systemic problems that are leading to this, what I call, gridlock.
Yeah. Well, make a case. What is the case for bipartisan cooperation?
Well, the system is set up to require it. It is a very rare moment, whether it's in state government or in the federal government, where one side or the other will have such a dominating presence that they can actually push through their agenda. Those instances are rare, if not non-existent. Therefore, to get things done, and that means looking at the challenges that face America or Wisconsin or North Carolina, where I'm from, and say, okay, how do we try to deal with these problems that face us and reach some kind of common ground, common solution where we can move forward. The state of gridlock means that you have perpetual arguments, you have half solutions, you have things that actually make the problems worse, and that leads to, you know, I think in a lot of ways, America falling behind, not being able to grapple with the very real challenges of the 21st century.
Mm-hmm. Well, following up just a bit on the situation in Wisconsin, and we're certainly not going to spend the hour talking about what's happening here in Wisconsin, but this is a situation where, I don't know if it was gridlock or not, we had Republican control of our legislature, both houses and in the governor's office, and a whole lot of big changes without really any Democratic input have just taken place.
Well, in some ways, I don't have a problem with that, because the way the system should work is that majorities, when they get control of the government, in some ways ought to be able to put through their agenda and be held accountable by the voters. And that's what is happening to some extent in Wisconsin. I just heard on the news about the various recall campaigns that are going on. And that's okay. People might disagree and say that these are bad solutions, but then they have an opportunity to cast judgment when the next election comes around. When you have a situation like we have in the federal government right now, where both sides are sticking to their preconceived solutions, their ideology, they're not reaching agreement, and then they are blaming each side, it's very difficult for the voters to sort out who stands for what people's positions are, and how to actually initiate accountability.
Do you think that we tend to think of bipartisanship as a really good idea? Compromise is a very good idea for the other side to practice?
Well, I think there's a lot of that. Sometimes a bipartisan solution will be categorized as something that where 100% of one side and maybe two members of the other side will agree to, and it will be trumpeted as bipartisan. A real bipartisan solution is actually when you have a majority of Republicans and a majority of Democrats, but agreeing, but also Republicans and Democrats, maybe on the extremes of each side, disagreeing. And so a consensus forms around the center, which is really where all the polls suggest the American people have been for many decades. The problem is that the political system doesn't represent the centrism that most Americans express in public opinion polls and their voting patterns.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about how this applies to, say, the debt ceiling debate in Washington. We hear President Obama and Democrats saying our side has already compromised. We will cut spending, maybe way more than some Democrats are comfortable with cutting spending in terms of programs they think are important, but are insisting on increasing taxes on the wealthy to help us through this crisis. But we have Republicans saying, no way, we're not going to raise taxes. We just have to cut even more spending. So what's going on? Is there a compromise here?
Well, there is a compromise. The question is whether the Republicans will take this opportunity to grasp it, whether ideology has infiltrated so deeply that even when there's a compromise that, to my view, tilts much more in towards the Republicans' view of the world and how they want to solve this problem, that if they don't grasp it because of a commitment to a particular anti-tax ideology, is a manifestation of this deeper concept of gridlock, which I described.
Yeah. Well, is this a game of chicken going on, a game of political chicken?
Well, in every negotiation, both sides are going to use various levers and pressures to try to achieve their goals. And that's what negotiations are, whether it's between a union and an employer, or every parent who has children knows what you try to do in a negotiation. And the question is, how long do you let that go? And, not every employment negotiation, sometimes there is a strike. So sometimes you get to the point and you actually don't reach agreement. Everyone thinks that this consequences are so severe with the debt limit that ultimately cooler heads must prevail and we must reach that consensus. But I'm not here to predict the future. I don't know exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah. But we also, I've heard some commentators say that the Republicans have drawn a line in the sand, have issued an ultimatum of sorts, and some even go as far to say that it's okay to let the economy go into default to some Republicans because that's going to make the president look bad. That's that doesn't sound good.
Well, a feature of gridlock is this notion of politics not as a process designed to achieve the public good, but as a perpetual competition where politics is a zero-sum game, that if one side achieves part of its agenda, that means the other side loses. And that is the systemic problems that I've been talking about that is getting deeper and deeper into our culture. Politics was not designed to be a competition. Competition is healthy, of course, but it has to be a deeper kind of manifestation of our community where what we engage in politics to better the whole. And the problem with our culture today is it seems like no one is willing to sacrifice for the common good, and compromise is considered if you give up something, that means that the other guy wins. And that's not a healthy way to run our society.
In a blog on July the 4th, you talked about the damage that is already being done in the debt ceiling debate, even if a compromise is eventually reached. What is that damage?
Well, there's a couple of things. We have to understand that the rest of the world watches the United States very closely. And the rest of the world, of course, carries a lot of our debt. So about $4 trillion in U.S. securities are held, about a quarter in China, and three quarters of that in countries around the rest of the world. For decades, since World War II, our creditworthiness, the strength of the U.S. dollar as a stable currency, and the idea that America, an investment in America, was 100% secure, has really been the bedrock of the global economy and a source of strength and power for the United States. And this debate, which has lingered now for 4 or 5 months, and having people say, well, it's okay to default, is damaging that element of our power, which is the strength of the confidence in the American economy and the American system. And it's put on display to the rest of the world, this dysfunction in our politics, where we can't rise to the occasion and meet a great challenge. So even if we do reach a last-minute agreement, those holders of that debt have to wonder, what's up with America? Is this really where I want to have all of my assets? And of course, if people stop buying, if people, countries around the world, stop buying our debt, are unwilling to, or charge us a premium because they're worried that they might not get paid back, well, that's going to be a great drag on our economy. It's actually going to make the deficit problem worse because the interest charges on our debt will multiply.
Well, we are talking about what's up in America when it comes to partisan politics and gridlock with a guest who says that compromise may be a lost art in American politics. We are talking about gridlock and the damage it can do, and we're welcoming your thoughts and questions. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. How do you think we can overcome the gridlock that we are witnessing in Washington and other states around the country? Our guest is David Schanzer. He's an associate professor at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. He is director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security, and he writes at Duke's Gridlock blog. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you with us. Hope you stay tuned. Tomorrow at this time, some are good, some are bad, and some are downright ugly. We'll talk about viruses with the author of A Planet of Viruses tomorrow after 8. All right, now we're talking about something that's making our political system ill. Gridlock with David Schanzer, who writes the Gridlock blog at Duke University. We have lots of callers, so let me take Jeremiah in Appleton first. Hello, Jeremiah.
Hello, Joy. Thank you, Joy, and thank you, David, both. I think this is a really complex problem, and I think there's too many things that really feed into it to really, try and tackle this in an hour. I mean, this is a really complicated thing. If it wasn't, it would easily have been solved by now. But I think two of the major points in this that I think are really key are the fact that we as a society seem to have a lack of communication skills, emotional skills, social skills. We've taken a downturn as far as that. And when I see a lot of the actions of the Republicans, in specifically the Tea Party, it's my way or no way. And it reminds me of that little kid who's got to have it completely their way. And they throw a temper tantrum when it's not. And I think that's one part. And, you know, the Democrats are to blame for that as well, too. I've seen that action the same in that party as well, too, which has made me become more of an independent. But I think the other problem is a lack of diversity in the political system, too. Most people now feel they're voting for the lesser of two evils, and the two parties have a monopoly. And when that happens, there's a laziness that occurs, and there's a lack of real competition that occurs. If we had more parties, we'd have more competition for real ideas, which is, I think those are the two key parts that we really need to change in this country.
Thank you, Jeremiah. Let's get a response or a reaction from Professor Schanzer first. The two-party system is contributing to this, Professor Schanzer? Oops, I had the wrong button on. Go ahead.
We've been able to have consensus politics with a two-party system. The problem is in modern years, the two-party system is essentially being driven by the extremes. A lot of that has to do with financing, the money, the energy, the people, volunteers to go and knock on doors, the things that win elections for you, is gravitated towards the extremes of the parties. And that means that's where the representatives have to gravitate to as well. And if you combine that with partisan gerrymandering, where it's not the voters that choose the representatives, but the representatives that choose their voters, what you have is individuals that come to represent a constituency that feel much more tied to whether it's the left or the right, and their political survival really depends on placating and keeping those extremes happy rather than reaching kind of centrist common sense solutions.
Yeah. Well, we're kind of seeing that in the presidential race on the GOP side to some extent, aren't we? Where the presidential candidates, even if they are more moderate, are trying to appease the more conservative wing of the party?
Well, that's what happens in our primary system. I want to talk a little bit about solutions, and I don't know if this is a perfect solution, but California has just moved to a situation where they have an open primary, which means that people from all different parties can run in the primary system. It's not just Democrats, Republicans. And the top two candidates, whether they're a Democrat, Republican, Green Party, mm-hmm. Libertarian, whatever, the top two will then go to a runoff to see who wins the seat. And, you know, it's a little early to tell. We don't know how that's going to affect things. But it's those kinds of systemic reforms that we might want to start thinking about and considering to try to relieve this problem of hyperpartisanship and extremism that is in some ways dominating our politics these days.
Yeah. How about is having some sort of redistricting commission rather than partisan politicians drawing maps for redistricting a reform you would recommend?
Oh, absolutely. There's a handful of states, I think it might be up to six or eight, that have done that. They or have traditionally done that, and some have done that, moved to that more recently. And I think that's a real important step that we need to take across the country.
Mm-hmm. Our caller also, he thought that the two-party system was contributing to this problem. Do you Do you see this gridlock turning people away from one of the two major parties? He says he's, you know, an independent now. I mean, do you see that happening?
Well, people have been turning away from the two major parties for a number of decades now. The growth of independents, people who are not registered in one party or the other, has been trending up for quite some time. What we've been unable to do is for a centrist political movement, candidates, parties that appeal to those independents to be able to break through. And I don't know if that's possible, but it certainly seems that if our system continues in the direction it goes, it's going, that there's an opening for that kind of political movement. There's a group called No Labels, which is formed in the last year, and they're groups of independents or moderate Democrats, moderate Republicans who are espousing this concept. And it remains to be seen if they're going to be able to turn what is a nice slogan and some ideas into a political movement. That's a big step. It's great to talk about, but it's more difficult to actually implement.
Our guest is David Schanzer. He writes for Duke University's Gridlock blog. Can our system address America's big problems? And our next caller is Chris in Milwaukee. Hello, Chris.
Hi. I'm sorry. I just do not see where both parties are causing gridlock. I only see that the Republicans are causing gridlock. If you look in New Jersey, where the Democrats had the houses of the legislature, and they gave in to Christie's demands and thought that they were going to get their half, Christie vetoed them out. Only one side got their way. I'm waiting for Barack Obama to do something on the left for how many years now? He keeps giving in and giving in. The only people not giving in are the Tea Party Republicans signing their no new tax pledges. And so I don't see that the gridlock is on both sides.
Mm-hmm. So what do you say to that, Professor Schanzer?
Well, I think if you had a Republican caller, they would point to many instances on the Democratic side where this was occurring. So, for example, they would take the issue of Medicare and say that, listen, we know Medicare is unsustainable over the long term, yet anytime you try to discuss that, people are accused of, you know, trying to throw grandma under the train. And that is, and then those people end up winning elections. So there are examples and counterexamples. I think with the rise of the Tea Party, that's perhaps reached new levels on the Republican side. And David Brooks in yesterday's New York Times certainly, you know, called that out and even questioned whether the Republican Party continued to be a real political party in the sense that it is, you know, able to capture the center as opposed to catering to, you know, what is a very a strand of extreme intransigence and an unwillingness to try to grasp the national interest above a very narrow worldview, which is being expressed in the Tea Party. But, you know, the Tea Party's new. We don't know if that's a permanent phenomenon or how that's going to play out over time.
Next, we go to Paul in Duluth, Minnesota. How's everything going in Minnesota, Paul?
Well, we're shut down, so mm-hmm. absolutely nothing is happening.
You're right, right.
But, mm-hmm. And I'm glad you're doing this show. I know you're talking on a macro kind of level on, you know, national politics, but I see, even on a personal level, no one is willing to take no for an answer. You know, the most petty, silly little thing gets blown out of proportion and turns into, if not open hostility, at least resentment. And from my personal point of view, this is the typical reaction to a whole society that is living in fear, economic fear. A lot of this started after 9/11 when, you know, we were trained to live in fear.
Well, I would guess our guest would have something to say about that, Professor
Shanson.
Yeah,
I mean, that's kind of the way I look at it.
Well, I think the caller has a good point. There is a very personal aspect to this, and if we look at our national scene, and it's probably duplicated in state capitals across the country as well, but nationally in Congress, you used to have personal relationships between the members. They were not zipping back to their district every Thursday evening and then flying in for votes on Monday afternoon. So they were together on the weekends. Oftentimes their families moved to Washington. They would go out to dinner together. They might share a few drinks together now and then. And people, they might have been in different parties, but they were also friends. And part of making a deal, getting to yes, is having at least a certain level of familiarity, a friendship, at least a camaraderie with the people who are working with you. And that's just broken down entirely. The members on both sides rarely interact. There are very few examples of close, what you'd call real friendships across the aisle, and they don't spend time together. They go their own directions. They don't eat lunch together. And so there is this personal element that is broken down over time. So when you try to think about solutions, that might be one of the areas where you try to find ways where individuals can get to know each other better. And then it's a lot harder to hold a press conference berating your opponent when it's your friend as well.
Thank you, Paul, for the call. Now let's go to Ray in Edgerton. Hello, Ray.
Hello, good morning. Mm-hmm. Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering to what extent the emergence of the politicized media, you know, the talkers, has contributed to the entrenched partisanship that appears to be underlying the gridlock that you've been mentioning. I'll take my answer off the air.
So how about the media's role in this?
Well, that is definitely part of this phenomenon. We have a much more fractionated media these days. It started with Fox News, and MSNBC has gravitated more towards a liberal bent. And it's more than just the networks versus cable. Also, people now are getting their news from so many multiple sources, blogs. I shouldn't say anything bad about blogs since I do one, but there is a sense, and a lot of studies confirm this, that individuals are actually, the media sources that they go to are more to ratify their preconceived notions of what is right and what is good and what the world should be, rather than to get informed in a search for truth. You know, there's a lot to be said about problems with the mainstream media and that it maybe it has a bias, and that's a part of this debate. So, you know, the democratization of the media is not entirely a bad thing. But when you have individuals who are not really going to informed, high quality media sources, but they're really just going to say, yeah, somebody I heard on the radio said that, and that I believe that's right. Those are more opinion than they are news sources. And that's a big problem for our society, because it's not only that we can't agree on how to solve our problems, we can't even come to an agreement on ground-level facts. And if you can't agree on the facts, then you can't even begin to agree on the solutions. And the problem is that different versions of the facts even are being presented in these fractionated media outlets and on the blogs and on the internet. And again, I don't have any great solutions for that, but I agree with the caller that that is a big part of the problem.
On Facebook, Ray writes, I find it interesting that Dems are now asking for compromise when they are not in control. The reason, now get this, that conservatives do not want to increase taxes is because we have spent too much already. Increasing taxes will only result in more programs and more spending and not lowering the debt. So he's saying conservatives are right on this one, and the only reason Dems are saying let's compromise is they want to raise taxes.
Well, this debt problem and the problems with Social Security and Medicare have been around for many decades. President Clinton understood that the baby boomers were going to retire and the costs of these programs were going to explode and we needed to do something. And he was unable to deal with that. President Bush, when he won his second term, the second President Bush, said that he was going to spend some political capital and try to reform Social Security. And the partisan politics of that blew up in his face, and his proposals went nowhere. President Obama appointed a debt commission that came up with a series of sensible solutions that could try to bring us to some resolution of this problem over time. And the leaders of neither party were willing to endorse those solutions. So it's really, it's not about one side of the ledger or the other. It has to be a both. And I'll just say to the caller, as to taxes and spending, our normal kind of average over historical trends of taxation is about 18% of GDP, gross domestic product. Our taxation, that's total taxation, is now at 15%, and that's a historic low. So while everyone consistently argues we're being taxed to death, we're being overtaxed, our taxes are low when you look at a historical, and it's also there at a very low rate when you're compared to other industrialized nations. On the same side, our spending, which usually has gravitated around 22% of gross domestic product, has exploded to closer to 24-25%. So yes, it is a spending problem and it is a tax problem. And if we're going to have to come, if we're going to come to some solution, we do have to address both sides of the ledger.
Well, and on the same issue, on Facebook, Joe writes, I am really worried that Republicans are playing with fire on this debt ceiling thing. Goes on to say that that if things don't go right, this spells economic meltdown. Are Republicans really willing to let this happen, Professor Schanzer?
Well, I don't know. I don't sit inside the caucuses. The framers said in the Federalist Papers that they envisioned that enlightened statesmen would be at the helm, and I have faith ultimately in our system, and that there are enlightened statesmen at the helm. And if they are, they can't push this to the brink and lead to these kinds of disastrous consequences. It is brinksmanship. There's no doubt about it. It is kind of hard-edged bargaining. Some people would say that's justified because that's how you try to do a negotiation. You try to get as far as you can. But as I said earlier in response to my blog entry just the other day, bad consequences are already happening. So it is time to end the brinksmanship and to cut the deal to prevent further damage from occurring, in my view.
David Schanzer, Associate Professor at Duke University Sanford School of Public Policy and Director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security, is here to talk with us about gridlock and the damage gridlock can and is doing. And we're welcoming your questions and your comments about gridlock versus compromise and what's happening now in Washington and other states like Minnesota in the country, and what we can do about this. What do you want to see happen? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Coming up, Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock. Kathleen and her guests will examine the upcoming recall elections in Wisconsin and how they could change the national political landscape. I wonder how they could change the national political landscape. Maybe our guest has a thought on that. David Schanzer writes Duke University's Gridlock blog, and he is talking with us about gridlock in America. Any thoughts on how Wisconsin's recall election might change the national political landscape, Professor Schanzer?
Well, it goes back to something one of your other callers said, which is there has been this resurgence of Tea Party thinking, a more libertarian streak of thinking in the Republican Party, and the mainstream politicians are very sensitive to it. If the recall elections, kind of like the by-election in New York State recently, send a signal that voters are rejecting that agenda in Wisconsin, those things can reverberate around the country, and that might, tend to marginalize the Tea Party strand of the Republican Party and demonstrate that the Republicans are going to need to cater to the non-Tea Party folks within their party and do more to attract independents if that's what happens. If they lose and everybody who's kind of been toting the hard line wins in the recall, that would also be a signal as well.
I've been meaning to ask you, since you direct a terrorism and homeland security center, does gridlock affect our national security?
Well, I think it does. The way I've been studying this really for almost the past 10 years is that I haven't really found Democratic or Republican solutions for dealing with terrorism. There's a great deal of consensus. And matter of fact, we've seen that in President Obama really by and large continuing and then amplifying in some ways President Bush's approach to dealing with this problem. Yet, if you listen to the rhetoric and the political debate, you would think that President Obama had was catering to was the Al Qaeda network. It's insane. The whole issue of Guantanamo and civilian trials, it's worth debating, but it's not. It is a marginal part of our counterterrorism efforts, and the differences between the two sides were really not that great. So we do a great deal of damage when we politicize an issue that we should have all Americans kind of pulling together. There's nothing wrong with debating differences, and I don't mean to say that, but it does harm to our system. One of those harms is that we overreact. We tend to overreact to instances because the politics of counterterrorism makes everybody seem as if they have to be the toughest. They have to show they are strong on terrorism, that they're willing to do whatever the case. And I'll give you just one example, if I could. In response to the Flight 253 unsuccessful bombing coming into Detroit, not far from your viewership, over Christmas 2009, what did we do in response to that? We spent billions of dollars to put these scanning devices in the airports that take a picture of you basically naked, which caused a great deal of controversy. And, you know, quite frankly, I think that those devices can be circumvented by a sly a terrorist. And so we spent $1 billion, and I don't think we bought a tremendous amount of security for it, but there was this imperative for somebody to say, well, I'm tough. I'm going to do something. I'm going to put the next best thing in there to solve this problem. And there are a lot of other examples of that. So I do think that hyper-partisanship is detrimental to our national security issues as well.
We have our lines full, so back to the phones. Victor in Oconomowoc is with us. Hello, Victor.
Good morning, Joy. Good morning, Professor. Getting back to what Jeremiah said early on, he's right, this is a complex issue, but I think it has some simple explanations and some potentially simple solutions for this, you know, hyper-partisanship. We're an older country demographically. I mean, when we were younger demographically, we invested in infrastructure, education, temporary stimulus programs. I mean, what was World War II but massive public sector investment? But now we're older, and our economy has switched from manufacturing when we work to service economy when we're older. And older people, older countries, perhaps find change more difficult. And I think that entitlement program growth has just exacerbated the budgetary situation. We're a capitalist economy, you know, and we don't have a common definition of what government should do or how it should be influenced. As far as what it should do, I would say let's use those microeconomic 101 measures of market failure. You know, government should only intervene when there's a market failure. Try regulation first, and if you can find a general welfare solution, then implement that. Otherwise, regulator, don't do anything at all. And that would immediately disqualify, you know, targeted sugar subsidies and ag supports and things like that as unnecessary because they don't appeal to the general welfare. As far as how to influence government, what if we just restricted our citizenry to the ability via constitutional amendment to only vote or contribute to those officers for government that they can directly vote for, not organizations? We've got to undermine somehow this united decision that came out last year from the Supreme Court.
All right, we've lots of information in that thought. What about, I don't know, is there some kind of campaign finance solution, a fairly simple solution, Professor Schanzer, to our problems?
Well, I don't think so, because unless we're going to change the First Amendment, which I doubt, the Supreme Court has recently, in recent years, has really taken a very dogmatic approach to campaign finance, and that money is essentially a form of speech, and it's protected. So on the edges, you might be able to try some things, but unless you get a dramatic alignment of the court and overturning certain decisions, the campaign finance system is really eroding before our eyes because of the court and because of other trends. So that's part of the problem, and unfortunately I don't see a lot of solutions there. On the question of older voters, you know, it's interesting. Older voters they come out more regularly. They come out on off-year elections like they did in 2010, and they do vote to protect those entitlement programs. And I always wonder about that, though. I think our system pushes people to maybe make older voters not understand the issues as fully as they're capable of, and also kind of appeals to the worst sides of their personality. I don't know a senior citizen who doesn't think first about their grandkids and second about themselves. And I don't think our politicians and our political system is kind of calling on that generation to understand the problems and do something for their grandchildren. And that's really, in a lot of ways, what this is all about. Our future is really at stake because of our inability to be competitive globally, the erosion of our manufacturing sector of our economy, our debt, things like that. And I think older voters could respond to a message like that, but our candidates and our political system drives them to appeal to fear among the older voters, and that's how they react. So that's a shame. And maybe if somebody tried an appeal to their grandchildren rather than to, you know, what the size of their Social Security check were going to be, who knows? Maybe that candidate would be successful. Nobody's been brave enough to try it yet.
Yeah, we have, even though I know Victor has some other points, we have other callers. Mike in Milwaukee. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Joy. Thanks for taking my call. I'll try to be concise. Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask, is periodic gridlock an inevitable logical byproduct of the presidential election system? And would a parliamentary election system, even with a coalition government, be more immune to gridlock? Because we probably have the less efficient form of elective democracy in terms of getting policy enacted. Thank you for taking my call.
Hmm. So our system versus a parliamentary system?
Well, parliamentary systems are more efficient in terms of one party, like in the UK, controls both the executive branch and the parliament at the same time, and it doesn't have the same checks and balances. So one party is able to put their program through. We don't have a parliamentary system, and I don't think we're headed for one. But we might try to brainstorm about ways to alter our unique political system to make it more capable of party in power actually getting its agenda through. So, for example, there's nothing in the Constitution about the filibuster rule, but that gives a minority a huge amount of power, essentially a veto power. And if you're talking about 40 senators, you could have 40 senators from 20 states that make up, you know, 30 to 35% of the American population having a total veto over the legislation that's able to make it through Congress. You might also look at the terms of representatives or the way that the president is elected. You could base electoral votes not on the entire state, but on congressional districts. So that would mean that you'd get to 270 electoral votes if you had 270 members of the House of Representatives from your party being elected. And again, there's nothing in the Constitution that would prevent electoral votes from being distributed based on congressional seats. And matter of fact, I think a couple states like Nebraska and maybe Maine already do that. And that would align the president with the House of Representatives much more closely, which would enable more ability to get things done. So I think it's not about moving to a parliamentary system, but maybe tinkering around the edges with the system that we have.
We have just a minute to go. Are you optimistic that we'll break the gridlock, at least the current debate over the debt ceiling, by August?
You know, I'd like to end on a positive note. So I do think a deal will be struck because it has to be struck. And it's there for the taking. As I said, I hope that enlightened statesmen are at the helm and that they do prevail and they are able to, you know, understand that the national interest has to take precedence to a very narrow partisan interest. Let's say a hopeful yes on that.
Thank you very much for being with us. David, David Schanzer, associate professor at Duke University Sanford School of Public Policy. He writes Duke University's Gridlock blog. Thanks to Rob Ferret and to Chris Molina for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.